Shabbat Zachor always brings with it hardest Torah of the year and Haftarah of the year. The Maftir reading reminds us that the Torah essentially defines evil as the behavior of the Amalekites, who rather than attacking the drafted, able-bodied men of the Israelites, specifically chose to attack women, children, and the elderly in sneak attacks. It's remarkable that the Torah located evil in what we essentially define as terrorism, and it did so well over 3,000 years ago. Anyone who thinks the Torah does not apply to the issues of today, of modernity and postmodernity, has never read it. And its message is even more jarring because, unlike even 20 years ago, following 9/11, when there was a general agreement that terrorism had the quality of evil, if anything at all does, we are in a world today where that's been flipped on its head, with many seeing actions of terrorists as those of freedom fighters, those representing moral action, noble action. But even in a normal year, as we are reminded of the definition of evil in Judaism by being required to read that section of Torah before Purim, the rabbis direct us to read a haftarah that seems meant to unnerve us. We read, of course, of God's demand for the absolute destruction of the Amalekites, including their civilian population, and God's chastisement of King Saul for not following through. We cannot avoid thinking of this Torah being read before the Megillah, at whose end are the Hamanites, considered descendants of the Amalekites, being massacred by Jews. Clearly, the rabbis intended that we are required to sit with these ideas prior to reading the Megillah and entering the festivities of Purim. It's not just we who struggle each year with the command to exterminate the Amalekites. The Jewish tradition has struggled with that command for thousands of years. Many Jewish sources declare that the Amalekites no longer exist, and so there is no justification for massacre. Rabbinic authorities use the Saul example to determine, as Maimonides does in his legal code, that having being reminded that Saul was commanded to do it is a reminder that you have to be a king to be commanded to do it, so that no Jew may kill a non-Jew under the guise of killing an Amalekite. Talmudic commentators argued that the calls to spare no Amalekite were metaphorical and did not require the actual killing of Amalekites. In Hasidism, the Sfat Emet interpreted the command as hating an Amalek, but not performing any physical action. The Chofetz Chaim said, it is our job these days to lead Amalek to God, and our only mitzvah is to remember what Amalek did to us. These were not the sources, however, that came up this week when I Googled Jewish sources on the Amalekites. Mainstream Jewish websites, mostly Orthodox, that conduct Q&A answers, where people are answering, are the Gazans the Amalekites of today? And of course they are. And we're absolutely commanded to kill them. It's not a pleasant week for a Rav Nadav doing research. That doesn't seem to me to be the right answer for this complex question that we Jews face each year. And it certainly doesn't seem to me to be the right answer here as we sit heading into Erev Purim, when we are reading a story located in ancient Persia, which of course today is Iran, where the Amalekite Hamanites are fomenting the genocide of the Jews. So how are we to feel about reading the end of the Megillah tonight and tomorrow? Are we to see in it that God wants the Jews to exterminate the Hamanite population, men, women, and children? Is civilian death a military consequence that Amalekites hide among their civilians, as it seems to be in the Torah? Is civilian death a consequence of the actions, or is it somehow desirable? So let's read it. Esther chapter 9. The decree goes into effect. The king has permitted the Jews, this is the decree of the king, the king has permitted the Jews of every city to assemble and fight for their lives. If any people or province attacks them, they may destroy, massacre, and exterminate its armed force together with women and children and plunder their possessions on a single day in all of the provinces of King Ahasuerus, namely on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. In wrestling with the text, the Jewish tradition notes several factors that lead to chapter 9. First of all, the basic principle of the narrative of the story is reversal. Everything that happens then becomes its opposite. So if you look, the words of chapter 9 almost perfectly match the words of the decree of chapter 3, which reads, on the 13th day of the first month, the king's scribes were summoned and a decree was issued as Haman directed to the king's satraps, to the governors of every province and to the officials of every people, to every province in its own script and to every people in its own language. The orders were issued in the name of King Ahasuerus and sealed with the king's signet. This is going to be important in a moment. And accordingly, written instructions were dispatched by couriers to all the king's provinces to destroy, massacre, and exterminate all the Jews, young and old, children and women, on a single day, the 13th day of the 12th month, that is the month of Adar. Since the narrative of the story follows the principle of Nahafohu, a series of everything being turned upside down, things becoming their exact opposites, then the decree to massacre the Hamanites does not exist in a vacuum. It follows the required pattern. But is that to give us any solace about a sanctioned massacre? Well, it does question the degree to which it is sanctioned by God at all. Famously, God does not appear in the Megillah at all. The decree comes from the Persian king, not from God. And the fact that the Hamanites are massacred, therefore, does not mean that this is necessarily the will of God, nor that it is more. In fact, it is not the outcome that Esther asked for. When she entreated the king on her life, what did she entreat him for? She said, if your majesty, from when Esther reveals her Jewishness, she says, if your majesty will do me the favor and it pleases your majesty, let my life be granted me as my wish and my people as my request. For we have been sold, my people and I, to be destroyed, massacred, and exterminated. Had we only been sold as slaves, I would have kept silent, for that would not be worthy of your attention. But if it please your majesty, and if I've won your favor and the proposal seems right to your majesty, if I am pleasing to you, then let dispatches be written countermanding those that were written by Haman, son of Hammedata, the Agagite, embodying his plot to annihilate the Jews throughout the king's province. For how can I bear to see the disaster that will befall my people? And how can I bear to see the destruction of my kin? So actually, the request of Esther is not for a revenge massacre. Actually, it's simply that the king uses the king's power to rescind the decree so that the Jews are not killed. That's what she's wishing for. So why doesn't it happen? The commentator, along with other Jewish commentators, Emmanuel of Rome, he was an Italian rabbi and poet who lived in the early 1300s, he explained, along with many of the other commentators, the issue is because the decree that the king has issued is signed with his signet ring. It is therefore an automatic law and cannot be rescinded even by the king. The king refuses to lower himself to declare that anything that he signed could be annulled. Therefore, all the king is able to do is to add to that decree with another decree. So that the decree, according to Manuel of Rome writes, the decree that Hamanites may attack Jews could not be changed. And that decree is still in effect. The only thing that can be changed is that now the Jews are allowed to fight back. It was not Esther or Mordecai's wish for killing to happen at all. But since the killing by the Hamanites was already sanctioned by the king, then they were left in a situation of desperation. The way the rabbis understand this is when the issue was first said that Jews can be massacred, no one did anything. None of the Persians wanted to stand up and say, this is wrong. No one was ready to defend them. So the fact that the king will allow the fact that one is still allowed to kill Jews, all the king can do is say the Jews can fight back. It's like the rest of the world has withdrawn from the situation. It's as if today, as I heard on the PBS NewsHour the other day, well, what could be done? One commentator said, well, the Arab nations, Europeans, Americans, they could put a force together and send them into Gaza and enforce a two-state solution or enforce peace. But frankly, there's no will for the nations to send any of their own. The king wants to stay out of it. In other words, it's not that the massacre at the end of Esther is the moral thing to do. Rather, it's an outcome of the logic of the situation. This is what happens when one group seeks the annihilation of another. and the world does not involve themselves to stop it. And in this sense, the rabbis see the Jews fighting back as not God-sanctioned or desirable, but logical. Interestingly, the rabbis point out that there is one difference between the decree of chapter 3 and the decree of chapter 8. It is, and you may have caught it when I did the English translation, Lahashmid laharog ulabed et kol chel. Et kol chel am. Whereas the first decree said, people, the Hamanites, everyone's welcome to kill, massacre, destroy, and murder the Jews. Here, the decree is that the Jews may massacre, kill, and destroy the chayil, the armed force of the nation that they're against. And only following that, women and children. At least the distinction is made that the fight is not with the women and children. The fight is not with civilians, but the fight is against an armed force so that we do not become Amalekites ourselves. The discomfort with the Jewish attack on civilians resonates for the rabbis. They note, for example, in Esther chapter 9, the description of the attack when it says, and the Jews struck back at their enemies, it says that they struck back at their enemies and wreaked their will upon their haters. Why is there a distinction between enemies and haters? The Malbim commentator writes, because they were only to kill their enemies, those who actively picked up arms to oppose them, but they were not to kill their haters, people who hated them in their hearts, but took no action directly against them. With the haters, they only wreaked their will, which would be that they humbled them, but that they did not hurt them. Indeed, the rabbis cite the words from Pirkei Avot, often known from Rabbi Shmuel HaKatan, famous that when we study Pirkei Avot. If your enemies fall, do not exult. If they trip, let your heart not rejoice, lest God see it and be displeased. Interestingly, that's one of the only Pirkei Avot that's a direct quote. It's a direct quote from Proverbs. And the rabbis often quote what you probably already know from the Song of the Sea. It's in Tractate Megillah, page 10b. Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi asked, does the Holy One God rejoice over the downfall of the wicked? Because it's written as they went out before the army, and they say, give thanks to God whose kindness endures forever. Rabbi Yochanan said, what's the reason for these words, for God is good? Because God, may God be blessed, does not rejoice over the downfall of the wicked. Since the Song of the Sea was sung in the aftermath of a military victory which involved the downfall of the wicked, the name of God was not mentioned for good. And similarly, Rabbi Yochanan said, where it says in Exodus, and the one came not near the other one all night, this is referred to the ministering angels who wanted to sing Micha Mocha. They wanted to sing a song of celebration after the Egyptians were drowned, as it states, and they called out to say to one another, but God stopped them, saying, the Egyptians are the work of my hands as well. And when they are drowning at sea, how can you wish to sing songs? This indicates that God does not rejoice over the downfall of the wicked. And then there's a strange addition from Rabbi Elazar, who says, maybe God doesn't rejoice, but humans sometimes do. In conclusion, I am comforted by the fact that as we head into this Purim evening and day tomorrow, I'm comforted by the fact that there is one thing that this congregation is unified in, even when it doesn't feel unified. And it is that the ending of the book of Esther is an outcome not to be celebrated, and one that ought to have been avoided, as Esther wanted all along. These are the deepest of our Jewish values, which follow in the line of great Jewish thinkers who see the Amalekite command as the ones should be relegated to the distant past, regardless of websites that pop up in the present moment. And we also sit with our values, but also the reality offered by the rabbis, which is, unfortunately, in so much time of the world, the rest of the world stands by as two people fight, and they leave it to us to work it out. Shabbat Shalom.